Our speaker tonight is author, teacher, and activist Derek Jensen. He is the author of Listening to the Land, A Language Older Than Words, The Culture of Make-Believe, Strangely Like War, Welcome to the Machine, and Walking on Water. These books take sensitive and critical looks at such difficult topics as violence, child abuse, racism, environmental destruction, surveillance, education, creativity, in the ways that these issues are all related to each other. His upcoming books, Endgame, Volumes 1 and 2, are due out this summer from Seven Stories Press. They are anticipated to be powerful commentaries on the suicidal tendencies of this disintegrating culture and the possibilities for resistance, adaptation, and change. Derek Jensen's radically honest writing inspires people to reflect on the ways that we relate to each other and to the world around us, weaving together the personal, the political, the historical, and the philosophical. He writes moving and deeply personal critiques of the destructiveness of civilization and the impact that it has on our lives and the environment. Though he explores deep wounds, he also provides hope for healing. I would now like to welcome the person who has been called a rare and original voice of sanity in a chaotic world, Derek Jensen.
Before we start, I would like to thank Santa Cruz Freak Radio, 101.1 FM. KZSC, Sacramento Prisoner Support, Little Ghost Fingers for their excellent set, all the Santa Cruz folks who helped put this on, and in specific I would like to mention Stasha, Nick, Petey, Ariel, and the fellow who brought me this wonderful jug of well water, and also the sound person, and also the person who was putting up all the chairs, who was, I don't know his name, but he was in here a few minutes ago, and I would like to thank him too. That's a lot of work. Vincent? Okay, so I would like to thank Vincent as well. And I would like to thank all of you for showing up. I really appreciate that. I would also, sort of having to do with Earth Liberation Prisoners, I would like to thank everyone who keeps their mouth shut. I think that's a very good thing. Okay, so we have a few options that we could do. God, isn't that funny? You know, I'm the one who's going to be talking. It's like we. Okay, so we have a few choices as to what I could talk about. And so what I was thinking, actually, is that I would lay out those choices, and then since we live in a democracy, which is actually my best joke of the night, that I would, of course, lay out the predetermined choices, and then you could vote. And then I would ignore you and do whatever the hell I want to do anyway. But I figured I would just go ahead and cut to the chase and start off by doing whatever the hell I want to do. I have in my hands an extremely rare first draft of the film script for the movie Star Wars. And I don't know if you know this, but the movie was originally written by environmentalists and has a pretty dramatically different plot than the movie as it was finally made. And as most of us know, the way the movie really ended up is that, you know, sort of at the end, there's this Death Star, this huge machine that is capable of destroying entire planets, which, of course, is a wonderful metaphor for the dominant culture. And the Death Star then moves up. It's going to destroy another planet, and it moves up, And then Luke Skywalker, if you recall, uses the Force to fly past all the TIE fighters and then get in and drop a torpedo down through an exhaust pipe and blow up the whole Death Star. I mean, you basically remember that, right? Star Wars came out at about the right time for me. I was in high school, and which is a perfect time. And I really liked the movie a lot back then. I mean, I wasn't one of those nerds who watched it 400 times or anything. Besides, I was way too busy playing Dungeons and Dragons. That's actually not how the first draft went. The draft, as written by the environmentalists, the rebels do not, of course, blow up the Death Star, but instead they use other tactics to slow the intergalactic march of empire. For example, they set up programs for people on planets about to be destroyed to produce luxury items like hemp hacky sacks and gourmet coffee for sale to inhabitants of the Death Star. Audience members will also discover that there are plans afoot to encourage loads of troopers and other citizens of the Empire to take eco-tours of doomed planets. The purpose will be to show to one and all that these planets are economically important to the Empire and so should not be destroyed. In a surprise move that will get viewers to the edges of their seats, other groups of rebels file lawsuits against the Empire, attempting to show that the environmental impact statement that Darth Vader was required to file failed to adequately support its decision that blowing up a planet would cause no significant impact. Viewers will thrill to learn of plans to boycott items produced by corporations that have Darth Vader on the board of directors, and will leap to their feet in theaters worldwide when they see bags full of letters written directly to Mr. Vader himself, asking that he please not blow up any more planets. And scribbled in the margin is a note from one of the screenwriters. For accuracy's sake, when we show examples of these letters, it is imperative that all letters to Mr. Vader be respectful and courteous, and they stress the need to find cooperative solutions to the differences between the rebels and the Empire. Under no circumstances should the letters be such that they would alienate or anger Mr. Vader. If the letters upset Mr. Vader, the rebels' letter campaign to the Grand Moff Tarkin will certainly fail as well. Now, you and I both know that all of this should be sufficient not only to bring the Empire to its knees, but to make a damn fine and exciting movie. The thing is, there's more. Thousands of renegade rebels, unhappy with what they perceive as toadying on the part of the mainstream rebels, decide, in a scene guaranteed to bring tears to the eyes of even the most cold-hearted theatergoers, to stand on a planet's about to be destroyed, link arms, and sing Give Peace a Chance. They send DVDs of that to Darth Vader and his boss, the Grand Moff Tarkin, to whom they also send wave after wave of loving kindness. A few rebels sneak aboard the Death Star, and they lock themselves down to various pieces of equipment. There's a big debate held. There's a stirring debate has held on screen among the rebels as to whether they should voluntarily surrender on approach of the troopers or whether they should remain locked down to the end. And in a brilliant and brave touch of authenticity, the rebels never are able to come to consensus. Which, by the way, is how I know that there's never going to be an anarchist revolution. Well, there's two reasons. One way I know that there's never going to be a revolution is because of this. Because if people will pay for water bottled in plastic, they will suffer any indignity. And the reason I know there won't be an anarchist revolution is because a few years ago I was down in Florida doing a talk, and afterwards, probably 10 or 11 of us were going to go out to dinner, and we spent 45 minutes in the parking lot trying to come to consensus on who was going to get in which car. And the only way we were ever able to break the deadlock was this one woman finally said, okay, look, you three this car, you four this car, you four this car. We're like, okay, cool. So that's how the revolution's gonna come, is some woman just, she's gotta call it. Once inside the Death Star, a splinter group of rebels breaks off from those about to lock themselves down, and they rush down long hallways, somehow avoiding all the troopers. They burn a couple of transporters and use chemicals to etch Galaxy Liberation Front on the walls of the Death Star. And that group miraculously escapes back to the planet about to be destroyed, where, of course, they're held by the peaceful protesters. They can immediately and rightly be turned over to the troopers. Near the end of the movie, another debate is held among the rebels. And that's a problem I had with this screenplay, is that there was a bit too much debate, not quite enough action. But, of course, that's just art imitating life. As the Death Star looms directly overhead, a few of the rebels advocate picking up weapons to fight back, and they're generally shouted down by the pacifists, who argue that attacking those who run the Death Star is just another example of the Empire's harmful philosophy coming in by the back door. They state that the rebels who want to fight back are simply being co-opted by the need to control things. If we want to change Darth Vader, they say, we must first become that change ourselves. To change Darth Vader's heart, we must first change our own. We must above all else have compassion for Darth Vader and remember that he too was once a child. One writer put in the margins, excellent, this will be sure to moisten the cheeks of sensitive people everywhere. He doesn't mention, though, whether those tears would be of frustration. Finally, Leia, Luke, Han, Chewbacca, and a couple of robots show up and tell the others they found a way to blow up the whole Death Star. And the rest of the rebels, even those who previously have been in favor of surgical strikes aimed at removing Darth Vader, are horrified. They remind those four that the Death Star has a crew of 265,675. And in the exciting final scene of the environmentalist version, a scuffle breaks out between Leia, Luke, Han, Chewbacca on one side and everybody else on the other. And then all the normal activists chase those four from the room and from the film, which is not a big deal since they're minor characters anyway. Okay, so then what happens is the Death Star looms closer and closer to the planet. And so you see a shot of the Death Star, then you see the planet, then you see the Death Star, then you see the planet, and then you see the Death Star, and you see the lasers start to glow this hellish red. And they just get brighter and brighter. And then you see the planet, and then you see this little speck of light take off. And that, of course, is the environmentalist getting away before the planet's blown up. And then the planet gets blown up. And then the final shot of the movie, which reveals what a complete triumph this is for the rebels, is a still showing an article on the lower left of page 43 of the New Empire Times devoting a full three sentences to the destruction of the planet. Yes, we got some press. So I was doing a Q&A. I was doing a talk in Asheville, North Carolina a couple years ago. And afterwards, someone in the audience asked, how many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb? And I said, sure, I'll bite. How many? And he said, it wasn't a riddle. I was asking you the question. And it's like, that's not how this is supposed to work. And so that night in my hotel room, I was sort of fixating on the question, which says a lot more about my social life than I wanted to. And I came up with an answer. How many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb? 10. 1 to write the light bulb a letter requesting that it change. 4 to circulate online petitions. 1 to file a lawsuit demanding that it change. 1 to send a light bulb loving kindness, knowing that that's the only way that real change occurs. 1 to accept the light bulb precisely the way it is, clear in the knowledge that to not accept another is to do great harm to oneself. 1 to write a book about how and why the light bulb needs to change. And finally, 1 to smash the fucking light bulb, because we all know it's never going to change. So as a longtime grassroots environmental activist, and as a creature living in the thrashing endgame of civilization, I am intimately acquainted with the landscape of loss, and have grown accustomed to carrying the daily weight of despair. I've walked clear cuts that wrap around mountains and drop into valleys and climb ridges to fragment watershed after watershed. And I've sat silent near empty streams that 2 generations ago were lashed into whiteness by uncountable salmon coming home to spawn and die. A few years ago, I began to feel pretty apocalyptic, but I hesitated to use that word, in part because of those cartoons I've seen of crazy penitents carrying the end is near signs, and in part because of the power of the word itself. Apocalypse. I didn't want to use it lightly. And then a friend and fellow activist said to me, so Derek, what's it going to take for you to finally use that word? Will it take the death of runs of salmon so large that people are afraid to put their boats in the water for fear they'd capsize, so large that horses were afraid to get in the water, so large that you would hear them long before you would see them? Or maybe it'll take the death of flocks of passenger pigeons, so large they darkened the sky for days at a time, so large that they were as loud as thunder, moving 60 miles an hour. Maybe it'll take the death of flocks of Eskimo curlews, just as large. Maybe it'll take the turning of the sea off San Diego into a dead zone. Maybe it'll take putting dioxin in every mother's breast milk. Maybe it'll take 90% of the large fish in the oceans being gone. You know, what's it going to take, Derek? What's a threshold? Give me a threshold at which you're finally going to use that word. Thanks, George. So what I'm doing with Endgame is, or one of the things I'm doing is well, I'll back up a second. I ask people all over the country, do you believe that our culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? And the answer is the same as at least a couple people in the front row with chuckles. Oftentimes people laugh out loud. It's absurd. And one time, one of my talks, one guy raised his hand, everybody looked at him, and he said, oh, voluntary. No, of course not. And the next question is, if you don't believe that the culture is going to go undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the answer is we don't know. And one of the reasons we don't know is because we don't talk about it. One of the reasons we don't talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending that we have hope. And so this book is really about that change in strategy and tactics. And one of the things I do in the book is I attempt to lay as many of my premises out as I can in boldface, because I don't want to slide premises by people. One of the first rules of propaganda is if you can slide your premises by people, you've got them. And I don't want to cheat like that. And a really good example of that would be you hear some talking head on television say, how can we make the U.S. economy grow? Huh, that's a good question. How can we make the U.S. economy grow? But premise one, we want the U.S. economy to grow. Premise two, we want the U.S. economy to exist. Premise three, who the hell's we? And another example of this might be Hitler. Hitler asks, so what are we going to do about the Jewish problem? God, that's a good question, Adolf. What are we going to do about it? But premise, there's a Jewish problem that you have to do something about. It was said of Hitler that from insane premise to monstrous conclusion, Hitler was coldly, icily logical. And once again, I don't want to slide my premises by people. And of course, there are going to be premises that are inherent in the English language. And there are going to be premises that escape me, absolutely. And there are going to be premises inherent in writing a book. For example, a book is supposed to have a beginning, middle, and end. And one of the things I do about that is in acknowledgments. I mean, that's a problem. But in the acknowledgments, I say that. I say, I acknowledge some of those who have helped. And then I say all these acknowledgments are, in a sense, premature. It's customary after finishing a book for authors to acknowledge in print all those who helped bring the book to fruition. But this book isn't yet finished. If it's to be more than mere words, this book will only be complete when this culture of death no longer impels life on the planet. At that point, the acknowledgments and gratitude will flow like rivers rushing through canyons once blocked by now crushed dams. So premises. Actually, before we get to premises, I want to talk about one more thing, and then we'll jump into premises. And that's several years ago, an environmentalist friend of mine said to me that he thinks that one of the problems is that a lot of environmentalists really don't know what they want. And he was a forest activist, and he was contrasting that with the people who run timber corporations who do generally know exactly what they want. I mean, do environmentalists want smaller clear cuts, kinder clear cuts, fewer clear cuts? Do they want there to be a functioning democracy? Do they want for the Giants to win the series? And yes, it would be nice if we still had a world. What is it that we, they, whomever want? And I'm really clear on what I want, at least. And I can't speak for anyone else here or anywhere else, but I know what I want, which is that I want to live in a world that has more wild salmon in it every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has more migratory songbirds every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has less dioxin every mother's breast milk every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has more large fish in the center of the oceans every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that's not being dismantled. And I will do whatever it takes to get there. I will do whatever it takes to get there. We'll talk more about whatever it takes in a while. Okay, so the first premise of this book is that civilization is not and can never be sustainable. couple things about that. One is, several years ago, I was riding in the car with a friend of mine, George Draffen, with whom I've written a couple of books, and I was just making conversation. I said, so George, if you could live at any level of technology that you wanted, what would it be? And he was in a terrible mood, and he said, you know, Derek, that's a really stupid question. We can fantasize whatever we want, but the truth is there's only one level of technology that's sustainable, and that's the Stone Age. And we will be there again someday, and the only question really is what's going to be left of the world when we get there. And, okay, so let's talk a little bit about that, a little bit more about that. Well, first off, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of living based on the use of non-renewable resources isn't going to last. In fact, it takes anybody but a rocket scientist to figure that one out generally. And, I mean, for example, if you have an economy that's based on, I don't know, oil, to choose a random example, and there's a finite amount of oil, eventually you're going to run out. And that way of living will no longer be able to continue. And you would think that if one were reasonably intelligent, that one would begin to ask how one will live when that non-renewable resource is no longer available, theoretically. And similarly, it's the same with the use of renewable resources, that if every year there are fewer salmon return than the year before, eventually there won't be any. As like if every year there are fewer passenger pigeons than the year before, eventually there won't be any. I mean, there were so many passenger pigeons. There were more passenger pigeons than there were of all other birds combined in North America. And of course, they're all gone now. I've been all gone for a long time. But they were cheap. And, you know, we're all taught in school that evolution is based on competition. And that's really stupid. I can do a one-sentence disproof of that if you'll give me a couple semicolons, which is those creatures who have survived in the long run have survived in the long run, semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings, semicolon. You survive in the long run by actually giving your habitat what it needs, like salmon do. Like everybody does but us. The Talua, I live on Talua land in what's now far northern California, and the Talua lived there for 12,000 years if you believe the myths of science. And if you believe the myths of the Talua, then they lived there since the beginning of time. And, oh, I'm getting ahead of myself. We'll talk about this in a second. But there's one more thing, actually. There's something else, another place I have to go before I go to the place I have to go before the Talua thing, which is that, and you're seeing why my books are written in nonlinear fashion, which is that I'm really hot. Okay, so we're gonna see how much we raise tonight. The socks will go next. Oh, geez, somebody's reaching for a wallet. I would go further than saying that any way of life based on the hyper-exploitation of non-renewable resources can't last. I would go further than that, and I would say that any way of life based on the use of resources can't last. And the reason I would say that is because salmon don't consider themselves resources. Resources don't actually exist. Salmon are fish. Trees don't consider themselves a timber resource. They're trees. And that doesn't mean you can't eat them or otherwise use them. There's a great line by a Canadian lumberman. When I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. If when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them another way. And if when I look at this particular tree, I see this particular tree, I'll treat it differently still. And this is true across the board. If when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at women, I see women, I'm going to treat them another way. And if when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, I'll treat her differently still. A resource is there to be used, as opposed to, and that's true whether the resource is gold, fish, timber, or vaginas. And, ooh, you know, that's another thing. And we'll talk more about this probably later too, but I really hate the word vagina. You know what it means? It means a sheath for a sword. Yeah, exactly. A few years ago, I was doing an interview in Spokane, Washington, and this guy, the interviewer, said, you know, Indians exploited salmon too. And I said, no, they didn't. They ate them. And he said, what's the difference? I said, well, they gave them respect for the spirit in exchange for the flesh. And I knew that answer was kind of bullshit, but I'm a male, and so I was required by law to answer his question. And that afternoon, I went out, and I sat next to this tree that I had a long relationship with, and I asked the tree, what is the fundamental predator-prey relationship? And the tree gave me the answer right away, which is, if you consume the flesh of another, you take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. So if I consume the flesh of salmon from the Klamath River, I now take responsibility for the continuation of the Klamath River salmon. And it's like I got in an argument with this guy a few years ago because he was saying that because I use toilet paper, I'm just as culpable as the CEO of Weyerhaeuser for deforestation. And I didn't think that was right. And he said, well, go ask a tree. And I said, I did. I asked a tree. And the tree gave me, well, the tree didn't give me the answer, but the tree said something to me immediately, which is, you're an animal. You consume things. Get over it. And I thought it was really good. But then I also realized that I am culpable for deforestation, but not because I consume the flesh of trees. I'm culpable for deforestation because I consume the flesh of trees, but I don't stop Weyerhaeuser from deforesting. I'm culpable because I consume the flesh of trees without taking responsibility for the continuation of their community. And everybody knows this. Herons know it. Tadpoles know it. Bears know it. Everybody knows. And this isn't just a woo-woo thing. This is on a real physical level. If the mergansers eat all the newts in this pond, they won't have any newts next year. So I've witnessed this in a pond right near my home. Is the newts will come through, and they'll eat a bunch, or the mergansers will come through, and they'll eat a bunch of newts, and then they won't come back for a couple years. And the newt population will start back up, and then they'll come through, they'll eat some newts, and then, anyway, so, how we perceive the world affects how we treat the world. How we perceive those around us affects how we treat them. So that's really central to that. But that's fine, Derek, but you still haven't talked about the whole sort of culture. What does that mean for the whole thing? You know, why does that mean that civilization is not and can never be sustainable? You know, I've been bashing civilization for, God, 10 or 15 years now. And with this book, I decided I probably better finally define it. And so I've defined civilization as a way of life characterized by the growth of cities. And that's defensible both linguistically and historically. That's very nice, Derek, but what is a city? So a city I've defined as a collection of people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. And what that means is the Talua were not civilized. They didn't live in cities. They lived in villages and camps. They lived there, as I said, for 12,000 years at least. And they didn't require the importation of resources. They ate salmon, huckleberries, elk, clams, marine mammals, salmon. And then usually through the winter months, they would eat quite a bit of salmon. But they didn't require the importation of resources. And consequently, well, okay, so two things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One is that your way of living can never be sustainable. Because if you require the importation of resources, it means that you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource. And as your city grows, and I know resource, nasty word, but I'm just going to use it. As your city grows, you will denude an ever larger area of that particular resource. It can never be sustainable. And the other thing it means is that your way of life must be based on violence, because no matter because if you require the importation of that resource, trade will never be sufficiently reliable. If the people in the next watershed over have that resource and they're not going to trade you for it, if you require it, you're going to take it. And what this means is we could all become wonderful green capitalists, and this way of living would still not be sustainable. And we could also become junior bodhisattvas, and the U.S. military would still have to be huge, because otherwise there's no way for them to get access to the oil that's necessary to run the economy that just happens to be under somebody else's land. And it's like with a language older than words, I tried to show that the culture is really irredeemable from a psychological perspective. And we can go into that or not later, as the case may be. And with culture make-believe, I tried to go into why the culture is irredeemable from sort of a social perspective, that as long as you have the social system of rewards that's in place, the system will lead inevitably to atrocity. And with the new book, I tried to sort of show how the culture is irredeemable on the level of physical movement of resources. Once again, we can all just have the most pure and wonderful hearts, and so long as you still need to get, what's the stuff that's used for cell phones that is comes from Africa? Coal? Coltan, yeah. So long as cell phones require coltan, and so long as coltan comes in an area that is home to chimps, is it not, or is it? It's gorillas, okay. Yeah, as long as it's home to gorillas, fuck them, you know? We need it. And end of story. And we can all, you know, we can all use our cell phones to talk about the latest green technologies, and it doesn't matter. So long as it requires coltan, the gorillas are screwed. Actually, I've seen apes use cell phones quite often, but not gorillas. The ones that do use cell phones are often called Homo sapiens sapiens, and the reason they put the second sapiens on there was to make sure we got the joke. Anyway, so that's the first premise of the book: is this way of living is not and can never be sustainable. We can't just, you know, make a patch here too and make the thing work. Second premise of the book. It's like, holy shit, we're like 40 minutes in. He's got this. That's premise one's right there. It's like, so you all brought sleeping bags, right? The second premise of the book is that traditional communities do not often voluntarily give up or sell the resources on which their communities are based until their communities have been destroyed. They also do not willingly allow their land bases to be damaged so that other resources, gold, oil, and so on, can be extracted. It follows that those who want the resources will do what they can to destroy traditional communities. And all of my indigenous friends are saying, yeah, it took you a while to figure this one out, didn't it? The third premise. Our way of living is based on, requires, and will collapse very quickly without persistent and widespread violence. And this is true on every level. I mean, of course, it's true on the level of violence to the natural world, violence to those who resist having their land bases destroyed. And it's true on a more sort of a level that's intimate to most of us, more directly intimate to most of us. And there was a guy after a talk I did a couple years ago who said, you know, you talk a lot about violence, but I just don't see it. You know, I don't see how there's violence in my own life. It's just not there. And I said, well, first off, where's your shirt made? And he looked, and it's made in Bangladesh. It's like, okay, do we even need to talk about that? It's like, no, I get it. I said, okay, second, I'm just curious, do you pay rent? And he said, yeah. I said, why? And he said, because I don't own? And I said, no. What I mean is, what would happen if you didn't pay rent? He said, well, I get evicted. I said, I don't know what that means. What does that mean that you get evicted? And he said, well, the sheriff would come to my house. I said, okay, stop. Okay, the sheriff comes to your house. What would happen if when the sheriff comes to your house, you say, hey, I'm about to have dinner. Come on in. So you invite him in, and you feed him dinner, and oddly enough, you don't poison him. And that was a joke, Mr. Ashcroft, or Mr. Gonzalez. You can put away the electrodes. Anyway, so you invite him in, and you have dinner. And then after dinner, you say, you know, your company has been somewhat pleasant, but really not all that pleasant, so I would like for you to leave now. What would happen? He said, well, he would pull out a gun, and he would say, you haven't been paying your rent, so I'm here to evict you. I said, ah, so the reason you pay rent is because if you don't, some guy with a gun is going to come and kick you out of your home. It's like, yeah. I said, do you ever get hungry? He said, yeah. I said, when you're hungry, do you ever go to the grocery store? There's lots of food there. And he says, what do you mean? And I said, well, you know, what would happen if you're really hungry? So you go to the grocery store and you start eating food. What would happen? He said, well, they call the sheriff. He said, yeah, he'd come with a gun. The same guy probably. He's a real asshole, isn't he? And the point is that in order to exist on the planet, in order to sleep in a place, and in order to eat, to take nourishment into your body, you have to pay someone. And if you don't pay someone, somebody's going to come with a gun and do something bad to you. So part of the reason that our lives sometimes don't have violence is because we're going along with this system where you have to pay in order to survive. Okay, fourth premise of the book. And this is one of my favorite ones. This culture is based on a clearly defined and widely accepted, yet often unarticulated hierarchy. Violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is nearly always transparent, that is, unnoticed. When it is noticed, it's fully rationalized. Violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is unthinkable. And when it does occur, is met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. And there's so many examples of this. I mean, there's a whole culture worth of examples of this. You know, my own father was extremely violent. And the one time that my brother fought back, he was beaten far worse than any other time because my brother had committed blasphemy. The violence had gone up the hierarchy, which it should never do. Another example of this would be, Jaws or Spring Break Shark Attack. It was a movie made like a year and a half ago. I was like, God, I wish I was at my shark still in the world. I watched Jaws about the same time I watched Star Wars, and you know, I'm still fucking afraid to get in the water. And the ratio of human attacks on sharks to shark attacks on humans is literally about 20 million to one. Or where I live, I live in the forest, and I oftentimes walk through the forest at night without a lantern or anything. And there's bears up there. I was like, oh my God, aren't you scared? There's bears. I mean, they're like big and, you know, and there's about one person dies in North America every year because of a black bear attack. And let's contrast that with, I believe it's 42,000 Americans die every year in automobile wrecks. And I believe it's about the same number die every year from the health results, the direct result of automobile emissions. And so, I mean, you know, it's like bears. I mean, well, who the fuck's scared of a bear? I mean, we should walk through a parking lot going, oh my God, stay away. Or another example of this would be, of course, 9/11. I mean, when was the last time you ever heard a political speech that did not mention 9/11? Well, I guess it was probably 9/10. And there were, what, it was like 3,000 Americans died? There's 15,000 Americans die every 2 weeks from preventable cancers. I don't remember what the number is for how many Americans die every year because of, all those numbers I've given you so far are right on, but the next one I'm going to make up because I don't remember what it is. It's like, I don't know how many Americans die because of unsafe working conditions every year. 50,000 Americans or 500,000 Americans, 3 million. Every American dies every year because of unsafe working conditions. I mean, it's more Americans die from unsafe working conditions every year than die. You know, I was looking it up today, and I read about that number today, and I don't believe it because I read a much bigger number a while ago, and the bigger one's got to be right. No, I mean, actually, a place to look is endgame.org, which has nothing to do with my book. I sort of stole this title from my friend George Straffen, who runs the endgame.org site, and he has on there some other references to larger numbers if you want to, like, use larger numbers to pad up your, you know, how scary it is. But even if it's 6,000, it's still twice as many. 6,000 is what you said, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But then it was 10 to 7 million.
Right. But once again, we don't talk about those. Or what about, we're back to real numbers now. I believe 1 million infants die every year from the direct result of so-called debt repayment. But of course, those are invisible. All those deaths are invisible, as opposed to any death that goes up the hierarchy. And does anybody mind if I swear? Okay. My mom is really supportive of my work, but whenever she comes to one of my talks, afterwards on the way home, it's always the same thing, which is, did you have to say the F word quite so much? But we have some very important analysis of the F word here, which is, and it relates to this whole premise four of hierarchy, of violence goes down the hierarchy. And that's, I think that fuck is the most amazing word in the English language because it's all of patriarchy condensed into four letters. I mean, how strange is it? How twisted is it that the same word that means do great violence to means make love to? I mean, so somebody says to me, I'm going to fuck you. It's like, I need some more information. that's bad enough. But then you get a couple other things. One is I used to teach in a prison at Pelican Bay. And one of the things that any guy thinks about when he thinks about prison at all is of course the possibility of getting raped. I mean, not me as somebody going in to teach, but when you think about prisons, like that's the first thing. I mean, it's a stock joke in sitcoms and it's in every prison movie since Cool Hand Luke, excluding Cool Hand Luke. And there's an interesting thing about the rate at which men are raped in prison, which is it's lower than the rate at which women are raped in the culture at large, which means when it happens to a man, at least it's noticeable. When it happens to a woman, of course, in many states, it's not even a crime if they're married. And so when I was doing culture make-believe, I looked up rape. I did an internet search for the word rape. And the most common type of site that I found was not rape crisis hotlines or scholarly analyses or police reports or anything like that. The most common site that I found, of course, was pornography. And, I mean, this is getting really, really weird. And then we're going to add another layer to this, which is there's a great line by Catherine McKinnon. Man fucks woman, subject, verb, object. I love that line. Man fucks woman, subject, verb, object. And it's so, the objectification of women is so inherent in our language that even within the context of a loving heterosexual relationship, it's still almost impossible to not objectify the woman. So the man says to the woman, I would really like to be inside of you. You know what just happened? She's the object of the sentence. Okay, so then the woman says to the man, I would like for you to be inside of me. You know what happened? She's still the object of the sentence. So the man says to the woman, I would like for you to be around me. And she's like, I'm sorry, can you speak English? I'm not sure what you're wanting here. And all of this, when you combine the routine, the everyday, the ubiquitous objectification of women and the strange conjunction of sex and violence within a patriarchy, when you combine that with the premise for the book here, which is that violence can only flow down the hierarchy, suddenly that helped me to understand homophobia, which is something I'd never understood before. It was always really, really clear to me that if you don't like homosexuals, you just shouldn't date one. But this all sort of started to come clear to me when, in the whole beginning of the Clinton don't ask, don't tell thing, when some spokesman for the military said, and this is a direct quote, can you imagine what would happen if a private had sex with a lieutenant? I said, well, yeah, I can imagine that, but that wasn't his point. And he said it would destroy chain of command. And notice he didn't say if a lieutenant had sex with a private. He said if a private had sex with a lieutenant. So the point is that when you have subject, verb, object, and when you have sex and violence getting conflated, and when you can have violence only flowing one direction, that means that there has to be a fucker and a fuckee. And the fuckee always has to be the recipient. And when you have both the fucker and the fuckee being male, all the little tiny brains just explode. So suddenly I got it. And that also helped me understand. I only got this one a couple days ago. That helped me understand why the sort of religious right will often talk about homosexuality as blasphemy. And of course it's blasphemy because if you perceive sex and violence, as if you conflate them and you're sending that violence up the hierarchy instead of down, that's blasphemy. So we'll get off that now. Anyway, this is, I think one of the smartest things I wrote in this book, if I do say so myself, is that, I mean, it's really changed how I perceive everything in this culture about how violence can only flow down. That's why, I mean, like, between 4 and 6 Americans die every day because they encounter police. And, I mean, I'm sorry, did we hear about that? But at the same time, any time a cop dies, it's like, you know, it's a big state funeral with, you know, some gave all gave some with the bumper stickers. You know, the most dangerous civil service profession is garbage collection. Way, way, way more dangerous than cops. And when was the last time you saw a big state funeral for a garbage collector, you know, or bumper stickers, you know, some gave all gave? When was the last time you saw a Tom Cruise movie where he's this intrepid garbage man who's cleaning up the mean streets of L.A., you know? It doesn't happen because that's not, you know, pushing the violence in the one direction. And then, of course, when it goes the other direction, you know, if anybody, you know, sort of, oh, there was like this, that's a great example. This actually happened not very long ago, maybe a year ago. There was a guy who I believe is in Oklahoma, and I believe I got the facts basically right, but he, and if I have a little bit off, somebody can correct me and I'll just tell you to get the hell out of here. This guy I think got 7 years for beating his wife, maybe even beat her to death, and then he later spat on a cop, and for spitting on the cop, he got life in prison. And of course, that's exactly the way it should be, because that's violence going up the hierarchy. I've sort of beaten that one to death, now I'm gonna move on. Okay, fifth premise of the book. The property of those higher on the hierarchy is more valuable than the lives of those below. It is acceptable for those above to increase the amount of property they control, in everyday language, to make money, by destroying or taking the lives of those below. This is called production. If those below damage the property of those above may kill or otherwise destroy the lives of those below. This is called justice. Thanks for that chuckle back there. You know, I've been saying this one for like a year and a half, and I love that line about this is called justice, and you're the first person who's actually laughed at it, so I just thank you for that. That makes my night. Okay, sixth premise of the book. This culture is not redeemable. The culture will not undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living. If we don't put a halt to it, civilization will continue to immiserate the vast majority of humans and to degrade the planet until it, civilization, and probably the planet, collapses. The effects of this degradation will continue to harm humans and non-humans for a very long time. Seventh premise. The longer we wait for civilization to crash, or the longer we wait before we ourselves bring it down, the messier will be the crash, and the worst things will be for those humans and non-humans who live during it and for those who come after. If Columbus would have turned back, you know, Columbus was supposed to turn back, actually. His crew mutinied, and he said, give me 2 more days. And they gave him 2 more days, and on the night of the second day, they saw the beach. They were going to turn back. If they would have turned back, and maybe, you know, if this culture would have been stopped, if Tecumseh would have won and, you know, driven the whites back off the continent, or if, you know, if somebody would have brought down civilization, whatever that means, 300 years ago, 200 years ago, people in the Midwest would still be able to eat passenger pigeons. I mean, just disregarding, you know, passenger pigeons living for themselves. If people would have brought down civilization 100 years ago, people in the Pacific Northwest would still be able to eat salmon. There's going to be people sitting along the Columbia River 40 years from now. They'll be glowing, for one thing. And they'll be starving to death. And they'll be saying, there are no salmon because you didn't take out the dams that are killing the salmon. God damn you. Just on the level of, I mean, what's going to happen in 40 years? Is somebody going to be saying, God, I wish they would have brought it down then because there would have still been, you know, earthworms? You know, I don't know what. You know, what's the next thing to go? It should be, if somebody would have brought it down 80 years ago, we wouldn't really have to worry about global warming. If somebody would have brought it down 80 years ago, we wouldn't have to worry about dioxin in every mother's breast milk, flame retardant in every mother's breast milk. You know, the longer we go, the worse things are going to be. The eighth premise of the book. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. I've just made it impossible for me to hold any public office. Another way to put the eighth premise is, any economic or social system that doesn't benefit the natural communities on which it is based is unsustainable, immoral, and really stupid. Sustainability, morality, and intelligence, as well as justice, requires the dismantling of any such economic or social system, or at the very least disallowing it from damaging your land base. this isn't a premise, but this is something that has become increasingly clear to me, that the only measure by which we will be judged will be the state in which we leave the natural world. People who come after, the human people who come after, are not going to care about whether we voted or did not. They're not going to care about whether we signed petitions or we didn't sign petitions. They're not going to care about whether we were violent or nonviolent. They're going to not care whether we took down dams or didn't take down dams. They're not going to care about whether, they're not going to care about whether we designed groovy eco-villages or whether we came up with this wonderful eco-socialist utopia with free love all around. What they're going to care about is whether they can drink the water and whether they can eat the food and whether they have a land to live on. Thanks. That's the one measure by which all generations of people have been measured by those who come after. Okay, the ninth premise of the book is, although there will clearly someday be far fewer humans than there are at present, there are many ways this reduction in population could occur. Some of those ways would be characterized by extreme violence, nuclear Armageddon, for example, and others would be characterized by less violence. And, well, I'll talk about population for a couple minutes. First off, I need to say I don't think that population is a primary problem. I want to say something else before that, which is it's really clear to me, and I think it's clear to a lot of people, that humans have exceeded carrying capacity. And carrying capacity is the number of a specific type of creature that can be supported on a specific piece of ground forever. So you could have an island that could have a carrying capacity of 1,000 of a certain type of deer, and you could have 1,000 deer there forever. But if you have 5,000 deer on that, they're going to denude the vegetation, they're going to cause erosion, they're going to permanently decrease carrying capacity. And before we go on, you know, I know it's always said that there are no stupid questions, but I actually got one the other day. I was talking about carrying capacity, and it was on a radio station. There's this guy who just hates my guts, and every time I'm on this radio station, he always calls up to chew me out about something. And this time, the thing he wanted to chew me out about is he said, "How could you possibly say that humans have exceeded their capacity to care?" Well, that's quite possible too, but that's an entirely different discussion. Okay, but having said that, yes, it's clear to me that humans have exceeded carrying capacity, but that doesn't mean that I think that overpopulation is a primary problem. One of the reasons for that is because actual numbers don't mean anything. What's most important is the amount of damage that's caused. You could have 100 gazillion deer on that one island, and it wouldn't matter if they didn't eat shit or stand anywhere. But the problem comes when you consume and when you create waste. And when I think of overpopulation, usually what I think of is little brown babies with big bellies in third world cities. And I like to talk about overconsumption and that being more of a problem, because who actually causes more damage, that little baby or, you know, the average American? And I think the answer to that one's pretty clear. But actually, I don't even consider population to be a secondary problem, because I consider it to be a tertiary problem. And the reason it's a tertiary problem is because I really hate demographers. And the reason I hate demographers is because oftentimes they talk about a natural rate of population expansion, and they somehow end up presuming that humans breed like rabbits. But the truth is, I don't even think rabbits breed like rabbits. That presumes that people don't make rational family planning decisions based upon their social and personal and cultural context. And if you're raised within a culture that refuses to acknowledge limits and refuses to even perceive damage to the natural world, it's like when I said, you know, 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone, the response to that, I didn't say it, I mean, somebody else said it, I didn't say it, to the head of the National Marine Fisheries Service, the head of the National Marine Fisheries Service's department overseeing the murder of the oceans, his response to learning that 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone, and this is pretty much a direct quote, is we have to ask what level of decline is reasonable or sustainable. And so when you're within a culture that absolutely doesn't perceive damage to the natural world, it becomes much more possible for you to have more children than you might otherwise. And when you have a culture that's based on the ideology of growth, a culture in which you have, I don't remember where I read this, there's some book I was reading where it was talking about how people are supposed to be fruitful and go forth and multiply or something. And when you have a culture that book is on the bestseller list, that's going to, one that people within that culture are going to be more likely to have babies. There was actually to have too many babies. And there was actually, people may not believe this, but many of the cultures, many of the Native American cultures were more or less steady state. I mean, the Tala, once again, lived there for 12,000 years. And one of the reasons many of them were steady state is because I think the numbers between 250 or 300, there were between 250 and 300 different types of plants used for contraception among Native American women. And this is so funny. I love this. This has nothing to do with anything, but it's just a story I love to tell. That there was a time when a lot of male anthropologists were going to various indigenous cultures and asking about contraception. And they were asking the males. And they were then writing all these papers about how these people know nothing of contraception, but still they end up not having babies. And it's a mystery. And then about 20 years later, there started to be female anthropologists who would go talk to the women. And of course, this was female knowledge. I mean, the men's like, I don't know why they're not babies. You know, and the women are like, well, you know, you eat this one root when you're 16, you don't have a baby for 5 years. And when you're 21, you got it, blah, 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 blah. It has nothing to do with anything, but it's a really fun story. Okay, so someday there will be far fewer humans, and every cell in my body wants for us to have a voluntary transformation to a different way of living, and every cell in my body wants for humans to voluntarily stop overpopulating and overconsuming. You know, it's like, you know, if I ran for president, it would be on the platform of, you know, vasectomies on the House or something. You know, it's like everybody gets a vasectomy. I guess it wouldn't work. I mean, every man gets a vasectomy, but only one. I got to be able to somehow. Okay, it's like a chicken in every pot. We could say a vasectomy in every Oh, that's too nasty. I can't say that. Okay. So anyway. Every cell in my body wants for that to be voluntary, but it's not going to happen, you know? I mean, it's like we're already over the cliff, and we're over the cliff and we stop and hit the brakes. And what are we going to do about that? And this raises a huge, huge, huge and important question. There was this, I was doing two talks in one day in Eugene, Oregon, and this one woman hated what I had to say so much that she came to both of my talks. And at both of them, she was very, very upset. And she said, you know, she called me a combination of Mao, Pol Pot, and Stalin. And her reasoning was that because I want to bring down civilization, that I hate humans, and that and bringing down civilization would kill a lot of people. And I actually have a couple of answers to that. And the first one is that, well, the three answers. I mean, the first one is I don't hate people. If I did, I'd probably run for national office. My second answer is that when I talk about bringing down civilization, that's not a monolithic act. I mean, it's a million different actions in a million different places, and all billion different actions in a billion different places, and all morality is circumstantial. All morality is based on the circumstances, which doesn't alter the fact that there are some actions that would be atrocities under any circumstances. I mean, I don't care whether you're a member of the U.S. military or whether you are an anarcho-primitivist. If you blow up a children's hospital, you know, that's an atrocity. I don't care even if you're doing that to bring freedom and democracy to that country, that's still a bad thing. Oh, which, by the way, I figured out how to decode George Bush's speeches. And I figured this out when they did. Remember the whole freedom fries thing? They were no longer going to call them French fries. It's like, that's it. It's just simple word substitution. What you do is every time he mentions the word freedom, substitute fascism. And every time he uses the word democracy, substitute corporate control. And it's one-to-one correspondence. It's beautiful. So all of a sudden his speeches are like It's like, they make sense. We're going to bring freedom and democracy to Iraq. There you go. Okay, anyway, so, you know, it doesn't matter what your motivations are. If you blow up a children's hospital, that's a bad thing. That's a very bad thing. On the other hand, I think it would be almost impossible to make a moral case against taking out cell phone towers. I don't think you could do it. I can do it. I can do it. Okay, so you have this woman is driving down the road late at night, and she's out in the country, and her car dies. Oh, man, her car dies. I mean, how weird is that? Dies. The car doesn't die. The car conks out. And she drifts over to the side of the road, and she has a cell phone, and she dials 911. And the cops say, yeah, we'll be out right away to help you. It's a fantasy. Just go with it. And then, you know, she puts the phone down, and then she turns on the radio just to pass time, and she hears that this homicidal maniac broke out of the homicidal maniac place. He's going around. He loves killing women on lonely roads late at night, and he has a hook on his arm. So the cop shows up, and he's able to get her car started, and she drives away, and as she drives away, she feels this weird tug on the car. And then when she gets home, of course, she looks in the passenger side, and there's this hook that's stuck in the door. So thank God for the cell phone tower, because it saved her life. But we can just as easily make a case for how cell phone towers could, you know, cause an atrocity. I mean, she's driving home late at night, and she calls her mother. She never calls her mother. She calls her mother, and her mother rushes to the phone, and she rushes the phone because her daughter never calls. And she picks up the phone, but she rushes too fast, and she trips, and she breaks her neck. And then she gasps into the phone, you know, I just broke my neck. Call 911. And why do you never call me? And her daughter, thank God, has two cell phones. And she then dials with the other one. She dials 911, but she of course now is driving without using her hands. And the car veers off the road. She runs over three orphans, then runs over the last population of an endangered salamander, and smashes into a tree. And then the last thing she sees before she passes out, of course, is a hook gleaming in the moonlight. And so the point with that is that, you know, we can make up arguments that will keep us from doing anything. You know, we can make us some hypothetical that will make us so we actually don't do anything but sit in our rooms all day and hope that the feds don't notice us. What's the point? I have no idea what the point of all that is. Oh, the point is that that bringing down civilization is not a monolithic act. But the second point is, I mean, she's really right in that. Well, no. There's another point to be made here, which is that a few years ago, I asked Anuradha Mittal, who's a former co-director of Food First and an activist from India originally. I asked her if the people of India would be better off if the U.S. economy disappeared, and she said, "Of course they would." And one of the examples she gave is that there are former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Europe, and There are tons and tons of grain that can no longer be distributed to the poor at subsidized prices because of international trade regulations. And so I think we can safely say that the indigenous and the Amazon would be better off immediately if the global economy disappeared. I think we can say that many of the people in the third world, many of the subsistence farmers around the world, blah, blah, blah. And I would say even further, I would say that the messiness, the nastiness of the crash will come almost exclusively by those whose lifestyles are destroying the planet attempting to maintain that lifestyle. And one really good example of that is that we hear all the time, oh, we're running out of water, we're running out of water. You know, people are dying of thirst all over the world because lakes are unaccountably drying up. You know, it's like we're running out of water. Bullshit. 90% of the water used by industrial humans is used by agriculture and industry. So we're not running out of water. The truth is agriculture and industry is taking water from humans and non-humans everywhere. And it's like if the Glen Canyon and Hoover Dams just went and somehow the Colorado River actually reached the ocean again, if you can imagine that, if the capitalist press is still around when that happens, I'm sure they're going to bray as one, oh my God, what are we going to do for water? Well, I don't want to hear one word of complaint so long as there exists a single fountain in Las Vegas, so long as there exists a single swimming pool in Arizona, so long as there exists a single irrigated citrus orchard, so long as there exists a single irrigated alfalfa field, so long as there exists a single lawn, so long as there exists a single golf course. It's like I wouldn't want to hear a single word of complaint from anybody. with wanting to increase the Shasta Dam, one of the reasons, I can't remember if it's Barbara Boxer or if it was Feinstein who said this, one of the two said that one of the reasons that they need to increase that is because this part's a direct quote, it is Californians' God-given right to be able to water their lawns. And so, what?
Thank you, Jesus.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, but that doesn't alter the fact that this culture, I mean, we are essentially eating transformed oil, you know, and if someone were able to cut off the flow of black blood into the economy, you know, people would be starving to death. And what do you do with the knowledge that if we don't act, I mean, on the other hand, if you're civilized, you know, your hands are bloody already. You're living on stolen land. You're living on land. I'm living too on stolen land. I'm not attacking anybody here on this. You know, and everything within this culture, every action within an industrial economy is harmful. And what do you do with the knowledge that if you don't act, things are going to get worse and worse and worse. And if you do act, it's going to, at the very least, inconvenience a lot of people and probably kill a lot of people. What do you do with that? It's a classic double bind. You know, double bind is where if you choose option one, you lose. If you choose option two, you lose. And you can't withdraw. What do we do? And I was stuck on that for a long time because I didn't want to just sort of dance around that question. And then I finally got the answer. And is Becky Tarbottin here? Hey. She actually was the one who came up with the answer, which I now have just stolen and use everywhere. So if you don't like it, mob her. Anyway, no, I think it's actually quite a good answer, which we came up with together. And the answer to that particular problem is, if you've gotten this far in this book, or if you're simply anything other than entirely insensate, we probably agree that civilization is going to crash, whether or not we help bring it about. If you don't agree with this, we probably don't have much to say to each other. God, do you think that Barry Bonds is going to get suspended this year? We probably also agree that the crash will be messy. We agree further that since industrial civilization is systematically dismantling the ecological infrastructure of the planet, the sooner civilization comes down, whether or not we help it crash, the more life will remain afterwards to support both humans and non-humans. If you agree with this, and if you don't want to dirty your spirituality and conscience with the physical work of helping to bring down civilization, and if your primary concern really is for the well-being of those humans who will be alive during and immediately after the crash, then given, and I repeat this point to emphasize it, that civilization's going to come down anyway, you need to start preparing people for the crash. Instead of coming to my talks and attacking me for stating the obvious, go rip up asphalt and vacant parking lots to convert them to neighborhood gardens. Go teach people how to identify local edible plants, even in the city, especially in the city. So these people won't starve when the proverbial shit hits the fan, they can no longer head off to Albertsons for groceries. Set up committees to eliminate or, if appropriate, channel the additional violence that might break out. We need it all. We need people to take out dams. You know, there are 2 million dams in this country. There are 60,000 dams over 13 feet tall and 70,000 dams over 6.5 feet tall, which means if we only took out one of those 70,000 dams every day, it would take us 365 days in a year, 3,600, okay, so that means 10 years is 3,600, 100 years is 36,000, would take us 200 years. If we took out one dam a day, it would take us 200 years to take out all the dams. That's if we only do one a day. Let's roll up our sleeves. We need people to take out dams, and we need people to knock out electrical infrastructures. We need people to protest and to chain themselves to trees. We also need people working to ensure that as many people as possible are equipped to deal with the fallout when the collapse comes. We need people working to teach others what wild plants to eat, what plants are natural antibiotics. We need people teaching others how to purify water, how to build shelters. All this can look like supporting traditional local knowledge. It can look like starting rooftop gardens. It can look like planting local varieties of medicinal herbs. And it can look like teaching people how to sing. The truth is that although I do not believe that designing groovy eco-villages will help bring down civilization, when the crash comes, I'm sure to be first in line knocking on their doors asking for food. People taking out dams do not have a responsibility to ensure that people in homes previously powered by hydro know how to cook over a fire. They do, however, have a responsibility to support the people doing that work. Similarly, those people growing medicinal plants do not have a responsibility to take out dams. They do, however, have a responsibility at the very least to not condemn those people who've chosen that work. In fact, they have a responsibility to support them. They especially have a responsibility to not report them to the cops. It's the same old story. The good thing about everything being so fucked up is that no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. Do what you love, do what you can, do what best serves your land base. We need it all. That doesn't mean that everybody taking out dams and everybody working to cultivate medicinal plants are working toward the same goals. It does mean that if they are, each should see the importance of the other's work. Further, resistance needs to be global. Acts of resistance are more effective when they're large-scale and coordinated. The infrastructure is monolithic and centralized, so common tools and techniques can be used to dismantle it in many different places, simultaneously if possible. By contrast, the work of renewal must be local. I have a great new phrase, dismantle globally, renew locally. To be truly effective, acts of survival and livelihood need to grow from particular land bases where they'll thrive. People need to enter into conversation with each piece of earth and all its human and non-human inhabitants. This doesn't mean, of course, that we can't share ideas or that one water purification technique won't be useful in many different locations. It does mean that people in those places need to decide for themselves what'll work. Most important of all, the water in each place needs to be asked and allowed to decide for itself. I've been thinking again a lot about the cell phone tower behind Safeway, and I see now how these different approaches manifest in this one small place. The cell phone tower needs to come down. Cell phone towers, by the way, not only are they really obnoxious, you know, with, you know, like having dinner and the next person at the next table just yammering on about his latest financial conquest, not only are they obnoxious, but they also kill between 5 and 50 million migratory songbirds every year. The cell phone tower needs to come down. It's contiguous on two sides with abandoned parking lots. Those lots need to come up. Gardens can bloom in their place. We can even do our work side by side. And I think we should thank Becky for that one. The 10th premise of the book is that the culture as a whole and most of its members are insane. I don't need to talk about that, do I? Yeah, we'll go on. Do you see it too? I don't know. I don't know if this happens to other people, but sometimes a vision of Angelina Jolie will appear before me. And she just stands suspended in air. It makes me happy. Especially now that she's with Brad. I think that's much better. You know, back when she was with Billy Bob a few years ago, I was very, very worried. I was very disturbed. Because it was a very disturbing relationship. I mean, do you know that each had a vial of the other's blood around their neck? And then do you know where she had his name tattooed? Oh my God, I'll bet she was wishing his name was Ed. Speaking of genitals, did you know that Nicole Kidman does not like to wear underwear? I read that in the Chronicle, so it must be true. But I'm glad that she's with Brad, because I think he's better for her. I think they're happy together. And also, I don't really see him as a threat. Does anybody know what's the indigenous name for this place here? No, this place, like here, like this part of Santa Cruz. The ground beneath it, you know, this area. I mean, okay, the thing that I find even more disturbing than Angelina and Billy Bob together is the knowledge that, I mean, is that I know what is on Angelina Jolie's genitals and what is not on Nicole Kidman's. And it took me 2.5 or 3 years, it took me about 3 years of living where I do, to learn that there was a massacre of about 250 Indians about 2.5 miles from where I live, at a place called Yontaket. And there was another massacre at a place called Achillet, about a mile away. And then another couple miles further up, there was a massacre at a place called Hawanket. And I think it's really extraordinary that I know about Pedro Martinez's toe. He's not going to make opening day, which I think is a real tragedy. I know about Pedro Martinez's toe, but I can't name 10 species of edible plants and fungi who live right outside my own home. You know, there's huckleberry, salmonberry, salal, blackberry, huckleberry. Oh, and then those big red mushrooms with the white dots. I mean, it's what? They'll make it so I stand 60 feet tall. And I can break dams with my bare hands then. Did I mention that there are about 70,000 dams in this country that are over 6.5 feet tall, and if we only took out one per day, that it would take about 200 years? Just thought I'd mention that. And I find that one of the reasons we don't defend the places we live is because we don't live there. You know, we live with Brad and Angelina and with Pedro and with Barry, and I'm really hoping that he's able to play this year. I mean, he's so close to the record. Oh, so close. And did you hear that Durazo got cut by the Rangers? I think it was the Rangers who just cut Durazo. Man, he's gone way down. His stock has gone way down. He was great a couple, 3 years ago, and he's just plummeted. Okay, so I don't know the places I live because I'm interested in baseball. No, it's like one of the reasons we don't defend the places we live is because we don't live there. I mean, we're living in all these other places. You know, it's weird. I know how to navigate Word for Windows much better than I know how to navigate the game trails right outside my home. That's crazy. I mean, that's really crazy. Okay, the 11th premise of the book. I want to talk about identification for a second first, which is part of the problem is identification. And that's true on a really, really deep level and on a superficial level. I'll talk about the deep level first, which is that if your experience is that your food, if your experience is that your water comes from the tap, you will defend to the death the system that brings you that water because your life depends on it. And if your experience is that your food comes from the grocery store, you're going to defend to the death the system that brings that to you, even if that system enslaves you. As opposed to if your experience is that your water comes from a river, what a weird thing's that. But anyway, if your experience is that your water comes from a river, you'll defend to the death the river that brings that to you because your life depends on it. And if your experience is that your food comes from a piece of land, you will defend to the death that land because your life depends on it. Which is one of the reasons why, one of the many reasons why I believe that it was much more prevalent for, and it is much more prevalent to this day for many of the indigenous to fight back, not metaphorically, than it is for many of us. Which actually brings me to another thing that was said a few years ago. This is a great, great point that somebody just really sort of slapped in my face in a very, very good way. I was in Minnesota doing a talk, and afterwards this old guy stood up, and he's this like old Indian Dutch maple farmer slash hunter slash, you know, everything kind of guy. And he said, you know, there was a big fight going on between whites and Indians over fish a few years ago. And one of the things I really noticed was that, you know, and I've worked with a lot of forest defenders, and I worked with, you know, with the Indians there. And one of the things I noticed was that the warriors, many of the warriors were ready and willing to die for the fish. And you talk a lot about how much you love salmon. And so the question, and you know, the forest defenders I've worked with, even though there have been forest defenders who've been killed, obviously, a lot of them aren't willing to die for the trees. So the question I have for you, you talk a lot about salmon. Are you willing to die for the fish? And I said, in a fucking heartbeat. And of course I went off to the bathroom and thought about it for a while. But that's a really, really important question. You know, what are you willing to die for? And what are you willing to kill for? And what are you willing to live for? And what are you willing to be for? All those things. You know, what is it that moves you so deeply? I've thought about this a lot, that it's like, you know, I really, really, really love salmon. And, you know, I was just in Colorado doing a talk a couple days ago, and I think if I lived in the plains of eastern Colorado, I would probably be willing to give my life for the prairie dogs. I really love them, but I'm not in love with them, you know? It's like, I wouldn't give my life for the prairie dogs right now because I just don't feel, you know, quite that. And anyway, I think that that's a really crucial sort of question, you know? And it's not a question that somebody can, you know, I was mentioned at a talk a few days ago, and somebody came up afterwards and she was like, you know, I don't know what I would be willing to live or die for. And I said, how old are you? And she's like, 19. It's like, well, you know, when I was 19, I wouldn't have the faintest clue. You know, this is something that's developed organically for me. Anyway, I want to talk about identification for a minute, and then we'll do a couple more premises, and then we'll talk about, then we'll bash hope for a minute. Which is one of my favorite things to do. And the other thing about identification is that it's really problematical. So often, so many of us identify with the system in ways I don't think are really necessary. And one of the great examples of that is I had a friend who called me, she called me up a while ago, and she said, so how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq? And I said, we're in Iraq? I thought we're Northern California. He's like, Derek, okay, fine. How much longer do you think our troops are going to be in Iraq? I said, I got troops? Will they like, well, if I ask them to take out the Grand Coulee Dam, will they do it? And he's like, you know, Derek, this is why I only call you about once every 3 months. Because that's part, well, we'll talk about that in a minute. We'll talk about that a bit more in a minute. Actually, we'll talk about, that's a good segue to the next thing, which is that the 11th premise of the book is that from the beginning, this culture has been a culture of occupation. And the government has been a government of occupation. What does a government of occupation do? It moves in, it facilitates the extraction of resources, and it doesn't particularly care about communities. And, you know, all of my American Indian friends are saying, so it took you about 500 years to figure this one out, eh? I want to read something about that, about the whole culture of occupation thing. And I mean this not metaphorically, I mean it literally. If Nazis or other fascists took over North America, what would we all do? Oh, we'd watch television, by gum. What would we all do if they implemented Mussolini's definition of fascism? Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it's a merger of state and corporate power. And what would we do if they then instituted laws allowing them to put a significant portion, say 1/3, of all Jewish males from the ages of 18 and 35 into concentration camps? What if this occupied country called itself a democracy, but most everyone understood elections to be shams, with citizens allowed to choose between different wings of the same fascist or following Mussolini corporate party? What if anti-government activity was opposed by stormtroopers and secret police? Oh, that's one of my secret fantasies, which I guess will no longer be secret, which is that the next time they have one of those WTO meetings, all of a sudden all the cops will turn around and they'll start shooting at the WTO representatives. Because in terms of sort of class, you know, they have far more in common with those they're shooting at than they do with, but that of course would never happen because that would be committing blasphemy. It would be sending violence up the hierarchy, which should never, ever be done, except of course by experts. Anyway, what if anti-government activity was opposed by stormtroopers and secret police? Would you fight back? If there already existed a resistance movement, would you join it? Substitute the word African-American for Jewish and ask yourself the same questions. Now, would you resist if the fascists irradiated the countryside, poisoned food supplies? Who was the genius who first came up with the idea of putting poison on our own food? Poisoned food supplies made rivers unfit for swimming and so filthy you wouldn't even dream of drinking from them anymore. What if they did this because... Hell, I can't finish that sentence because no matter how I try, I can't come up with a motivation good enough even for fascists to irradiate and toxify the landscape and water supplies. If fascists systematically deforested the continent, would you join an underground army of resistance, head to the forest, and from there to the boardrooms and to the halls of the Reichstag to pick off the occupying deforesters and most especially those who give them the marching orders? It's like, what would we all do if space aliens came down from, that's where they come from, if aliens came down from outer space and they started to systematically deforest the planet, and they were vacuuming the oceans, and they were putting up 2 million dams in the United States, 70,000 dams over 6.5 feet tall. What would we do if they were putting docks in every mother's breast? Like these space aliens were doing all this. What would we do? I mean, I think I know what we would do, right? I know what I would do. You know, we'd grab our camo outfits, our AK-47s, we'd head off to the woods, and we'd... Wrong audience. Am I the only person here with an AK-47? You know, I was sharing the stage with Ward Churchill one time, And I asked that question, and he was not on the stage at the moment, he was in the audience. And I said, so am I the only person with an AK-47? Silence from the audience. And then I hear this voice go, nope. Anyway, what would we do if Islamo-fascists were, you know, invading this country, and they were, it's really clear to me that for salmon to survive, they need six things. They need for dams to be removed. They need for industrial forestry to stop. They need for industrial fishing to stop. They need for industrial agriculture to stop because of runoff. They need for global warming to stop, which means they need the oil economy to stop. And they need for the oceans to stop being murdered. Those are six straightforward technical tasks. That doesn't mean they aren't daunting, but it means they are straightforward tasks. It is not cognitively difficult to figure out what salmon need to survive. It's pretty straightforward. Robert J. Lifton wrote this great, great book called The Nazi Doctors. And he asked the fundamental question, how could people who had taken the Hippocratic Oath work in death camps? And the answer he came up with by interviewing them was really, really extraordinary, which is that many of the doctors, and he's not talking about Mengele or the people like him, he was talking about, you know, sort of the average doctors in the death and work camps. And what he found was that many of them actually did everything they could to make things better for the Jews and other inmates in the camps. Everything within their power, except question the larger concentration camp. So they would give someone who was in pain, they would give them an aspirin to lick. They would hide them from people making selections. They would, selections for murder. They would do all these things. They would do everything except question the concentration camp. And so often, and I say this as a long-term grassroots environmental activist, you know, I'm not throwing stones, you know, I'm throwing stones at a rubber wall that are bouncing back and hitting me in the face here, that what we do so often is we do everything we can to save this or that piece of ground, except question the larger picture. And so what we end up doing is it becomes incredibly difficult. How are we going to save salmon? I guess the question we're really asking is, how are we going to save salmon without taking out dams, without stopping industrial logging, without stopping industrial fishing, without stopping the murder of the oceans, without stopping global warming? How are we going to do it when we put on all those constraints? It's like, how are we going to keep the inmates alive without breaking down the fucking walls? I'm not interested anymore in keeping the inmates alive. I'm interested in breaking down the fucking walls. Okay, and thank you very much for that. But even if your sense of kin and your sense of skin doesn't extend to the natural world, and even if you don't yet love the land where you live enough that you'd fight for it, what would you do if the fascists toxify not only the landscape, but the bodies of those you love? What if their actions put dioxin and dozens of other carcinogens into the flesh of your lover, children, mother, brother, sister, father? How many people in this room have had someone you love die of cancer? About 60%, 50%, so that's 60%. Yeah, and cancer, of course, is a disease of civilization. I have Crohn's disease. I'm having a terrible flare-up right now, and Crohn's disease, of course, is a disease of civilization. Would you fight back? What if the fascists toxify your own body? Would you still cling to the illusion that their edicts carry more weight than that brought to bear by their secret and not-so-secret police? Would you work for this regime? Would you teach others its virtues? Or would you fight back? If you won't fight back when they toxify your own body, when precisely will you fight back? Give me, and more importantly yourself, a specific threshold at which you finally take a stand. If you can't or won't give the threshold, why not? None of these questions are rhetorical. The questions are real. They are, at this point, some of the most important questions there are. We're going to do three more premises real fast, and then bash hope, and then read a couple things. Okay. So, next premise. There are no rich people in the world, and there are no poor people. There's people. The rich may have lots of pieces of paper that many pretend are worth something, and the poor may not. The rich claim they own land, and the poor are often denied the right to make the same claim. A primary purpose of the police is to enforce the delusions of those with lots of pieces of paper. Those without the papers generally buy into these delusions almost as quickly and completely as those with. These delusions carry with them extreme consequences in the real world. Weyerhaeuser doesn't own any land. Well, Weyerhaeuser doesn't even exist. But PL doesn't own any land. Sierra Pacific doesn't own any land. Sierra Pacific, presuming it exists, owns pieces of paper that say that they own land, and we all agree with that. It's like there's a bunch of cars out there, and nobody owns those cars. We all agree that they own those cars. And, of course, I can say this because my car is up in Crescent City, and so it's like doesn't matter to me. But the point is those are all social agreements. And I'm not saying that all social agreements are bad. What I'm saying is that social agreements are social agreements. And with all the world at stake, we should probably begin to ask ourselves which of these social agreements we want to maintain and which of these social agreements facilitate our survival. The 13th premise of the book. Those in power rule by force, and the sooner we break ourselves of the illusions to the contrary, the sooner we can at least begin to make reasonable decisions about whether, when, how we're going to resist. And the 15th premise, I'm jumping to the 15th premise just because I love this premise so much. I want to mention this one. Love doesn't imply pacifism. I've had it thrown at me so often. You know, God, Derek, if you just... You know, you talk about fighting back. Well, first off, you talk about fighting back, and that's so dualistic. You talk about them as enemy. You talk about them. You talk about an enemy. That's so dualistic, so divisive. You know what? If you want to eradicate dualism, you're being dualistic. Because what you're saying is dualism bad, non-dualism good. It's like, checkmate. The point of that is that the word that they have that's wrong there is sort of the word versus. You know, it's like opposites exist, and sometimes it's appropriate for one and sometimes it's appropriate for other. There are times when it's appropriate to be dualistic and sometimes when it's appropriate to not be dualistic. Sometimes it's appropriate. It's like, yeah, men and women are different. And sometimes it's appropriate for them to work together. Sometimes it's appropriate for them to work in opposition. Sometimes it's appropriate for them to work independently. Humans are different than non-humans. And sometimes it's appropriate for us to work together. Sometimes it's appropriate for us to work against each other. Sometimes it's appropriate for us to work independently. Salmon are different than non-salmon. You know, all these opposites exist. And, I mean, violence is different than non-violence. And there are times when it's appropriate to be violent. And there's times when it's appropriate to be non-violent. And so anyway, back to love does not imply passive. And this has sort of been thrown at me, you know. It's like, God, you know, Derek, if you just felt more love, if you just had more love for the capitalists, then things would be what? I don't know what they're saying I should, but I don't know what's supposed to happen when I do. Then you'll feel better, Derek. And they'll say, you know, if you really loved, you wouldn't want to fight. And I grew up in the country. And I have been attacked by mother horses, cows, hawks, eagles, spiders, mice, who thought I was attacking their babies. And if a mother mouse will take on someone 6,000 times her size, what the hell's wrong with us? You know, it's like love does not imply pacifism. I don't think mother grizzly bears are going to agree with you on that one. Oh, you know, I got to say this, and then we'll move on to the whole bashing thing. This book was originally supposed to be like a 100-page pamphlet taking all the arguments that dogmatic pacifists always throw out and shooting them down one by one. Just because I've done some talks that are specifically about violence before, and I always get the same sort of responses. People always like throw out the you can't use the master's tools to dismantle the master's house. And I just love that one because, I mean, first off, that's not what Audre Lorde was talking about. Audre Lorde was not a pacifist. And also, I think it's really clear that Audre Lorde was never work construction because it actually doesn't matter whose tools you use to dismantle whose house. You can use anybody's tools you want to dismantle the house. And it also presumes, see, that's another problem, is that presumes, and once again, Audre Lorde wasn't using it this way, but when that's used, you can't use the master's tools, meaning violence, that presumes that that violence is one of the master's tools. And you know what? Those in power say they own the land, they say they own the water, they say they own genetic materials. I am not going to say that they own violence. And once again, I think Mother Grizzly Bears are going to back me up on this one. And, thanks. So two of us agree on this. Everybody else is like, stone the bastards. Okay, let's bash Hope. A few years ago, a friend of mine called me up and she said, oh, you know, I need to say one more thing about the whole pacifism thing, which is, in the language of the words, I wrote one chapter that I really regret, and I wish I never would have written. I'm actually pretty ashamed of it. And that was a chapter, I think, called Violence Revisited, where I say that if you commit an act of violence, you run the risk of becoming like the oppressors are. And that is one of the stupidest things in the entire world. If a tiger in a zoo attacks one of the zookeepers, does she run the risk of becoming a zookeeper? Did Tecumseh run the risk of becoming like the whites who were stealing his land when he fought against them? If a woman kills a rapist who is attempting to rape her, does she run the risk of becoming a rapist? It's like, that's insane. Part of the problem is that, you know, we only have, it's insane that the same word that means the same word, violence, that means a man raping a woman, also means a mountain lion killing a deer, also means, you know, somebody punching somebody else, also means, you know, a chemical company CEO polluting a landscape. Oh, sorry, that last one's called production. But it's really unfortunate that the same word is used. It's really, really squishy. And so lately I've been using to define violence. I mean, I love the definition, any act that causes physical or psychological harm to another. And I really love that because what it means is that violence really is ubiquitous. Every time you defecate, it's an act of violence because you're killing all the bacteria. And so, you know, and I've said that to this one dogmatic pacifist, and she said, you know, don't be absurd. Don't be, you know, it's just silly. And it's like, no, what I'm trying to do is to get you to define what types of violence you are against. I mean, if you're against defecation, that's cool, but we're going to have one discussion. If you have another discussion where you say you won't commit any act of, you know, you see where I'm going with that. Anyway, so back to Hope. A couple years ago, a friend of mine called, and she's an activist who was working on toxics issues in Northern California. And she said, man, it's just killing me. This is breaking my heart. This is so, so hard. I said, yeah, I know, it's really hard. And she said, you know, the dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does, even itself. She says, it has a death urge, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does. She said, unless it's stopped, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? I said, yeah, it is unless it's stopped. And she said, well, we're not going to make some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? I thought for a moment, and then I said the thing I knew all along was the best thing I could say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason I knew that was the best thing I could say is because about 12 or 13 years ago, I was undergoing sort of a similar collapse myself, and I was just bursting into tears all the time over the death of the salmon, over Kootenai sturgeon, bull trout, Selkirk caribou. A lot of my environmentalist friends were saying, so, Derek, just take some time off, you know, back off. The problems will still be there when you come back. And I knew I couldn't do that. I knew that wasn't what was appropriate. I knew I just had to keep pushing. And one day I was just sobbing, and I called a friend of mine, Jeanette Armstrong, who's an Okanagan Indian. And I said to her, God, this work is just killing me. It's just breaking my heart. She said, yeah, I know it'll do that. I said, man, the dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does, even itself. I said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does. I said, unless it stops, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? I said, yeah, unless it stopped. I said, we're not going to make some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And she said the best thing she could possibly say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best thing she could say is because it normalized my despair. And it let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. And it let me know that sorrow is just sorrow, and pain is just pain, and fear is just fear. And it's not so much the sorrow or even the pain that hurts as it is my resistance to it. And it let me know that I could feel all those things, and it wouldn't kill me. You know, there's this weird idea that if you recognize how bad things are, you have to go around being miserable all the time. And, you know, I'm a complex enough being that I can hold in my heart the understanding that we're really, really, really fucked. And that life is really, really, really good. And that we're fucked. And that life is so good. And we're pretty much fucked. It's like, life's really good. And somebody asked me one time, you know, how does your anger at the dominant culture affect your sex life? And I sort of wanted to respond, you know, that's a question to which you're never going to know the answer. But what the real answer was that question presumes that anger is a shotgun. And then it just shoots out at everyone. But the truth is that I'm angry at the things that make me angry. And I'm full of rage and hate and love and joy and satisfaction and dissatisfaction. And I love the things that I love and I hate the things that I hate. And what a concept, eh? And anyway, so I found that I could really fall into that. And I didn't have to take it personally. I didn't have to be miserable. And the other thing that was wonderful, you know, I found it wouldn't kill me. And the other wonderful, the even better thing, is I found I could feel all those things, and they would kill me. And there's a wonderful thing about being dead, which is that once you're dead, they can't touch you anymore. You can still sing, and you can still dance, and you can still make love, and you can still fight like hell, but they can't touch you. One of the smartest things the Nazis did was they made it so that at every step of the way, it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. Would you rather get an ID card, or would you rather resist and possibly get killed? You want to move to a ghetto? You want to resist and possibly get killed. You want to get on a cattle car? You want to resist and possibly get killed. You want to take a shower? You want to resist and possibly get killed. At every step of the way, it was in their rational best interest to not resist. But I'll tell you something very important, which is that the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. No, listen. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. No, listen. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. Keep that in mind over the next 10 years. One of the reasons that my mother stayed with my father was because there weren't battered women's shelters in the 50s and 60s. But another reason was because of the false hope that he would change. And what are some of the false hopes that bind us to the system? Does anybody really think that Weyerhaeuser is going to stop deforesting because we ask nicely? Does anybody really think that Monsanto is going to stop Monsantoing because we ask nicely? Does anybody think that if we can just get a Democrat in the White House, things are going to be okay? These people asked me to dinner before a talk I did a couple years ago. And they were some Democrats, and it was pretty funny because they said, "So what are you going to talk about tonight?" I said, "Well, I'm going to talk about bringing down civilization." It was so funny. It was just like I'd hiked up a cheek and farted, you know. So just they noses sort of wrinkled all around the table. And finally, somebody said, "Could you please pass the hummus? It's very, very good." And They were saying, you know, if we can just get a Democrat in the White House, if we can just take over Congress. I'm thinking, yeah, I wouldn't mind taking over Congress, but I don't think I mean the same thing you do. Once again, Mr. Gonzalez, it's a joke. Put away the electrodes. It's not only false hopes. I mean, what are the false hopes that keep us tied to the system? What are the false hopes that keep us in line? And it's not only false hopes, but hope itself. I was doing a talk a couple years ago, and somebody in the audience shouted out, "What do you mean by hope?" I was like, "God, I don't know. You know, I've been bashing hope for years. I got no idea what I'm talking about." And so I asked them in the audience to define hope, and they came up with a great definition, which is, hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. Let me put it this way. I don't hope that I eat tomorrow. I'm going to do it. I know men are supposed to be afraid of commitment, but I'm going to commit right here in public that I am going to eat tomorrow. In fact, I don't even need to commit to it. I'm simply going to do it. You don't hope that. It's absurd to say, oh, okay, how would this work in a relationship? Okay, so you're in this relationship and it's February 13 and you say to your lover, you say, "I hope I get you a present tomorrow." It's like, it's not going to fly. On the other hand, the next time I get on an airplane, I hope it doesn't crash. Because once I'm in the plane, I have no agency. So if I say, you know, "I hope there's going to be a cultural transformation," it means I have no agency. If I say, "I hope that coho salmon survive," it means I have no agency. I do not hope that coho salmon survive. I will do whatever it takes, and I mean whatever it takes, to make sure that coho salmon survive. If they don't like how they're being treated and they want to go extinct because of that, I will say goodbye and I will miss them. But if they do not want to go extinct, I will not allow the dominant culture to drive them extinct. I will do whatever it takes. I do not hope that coho salmon survive. It is customary when talking about the apocalypse to end on a happy note. So I'm going to read a happy piece and then an inspirational piece. And this piece starts off, "Pretend You're a River." And it's pretty interesting because I didn't write it. I was trying to write it, and I wanted to write what it would be like to be a river, what it is like to be a river. I tried for several days, and then finally I thought, "Derek, you are such an idiot. You live about 20 yards from a stream. You know, instead of you making it up, why don't you go out, just go ask the stream?" And I went out and I stood next to the stream. I said, "So what's it like to be you?" And literally within 10 seconds, I had it. I ran back inside as fast as I could and wrote it down. Didn't even edit a word. The stream's a much better writer than I am. "Pretend you are a river. Pretend you are the mist who falls so fine, so gentle, that nothing separates water and air. You are the rain who falls in sheets, explodes onto the ground to leave pocks and puddles. You are the ground who receives this water, soaking it up, taking it in, carrying it deep inside. You are the cracks and fissures where the waters accumulate, flow, fall to join more water and more in pools and rivers who move slowly through cavities, crevices, pores. You are the sounds and silence of water seeping or staying still. You are the meeting of wet and dry, the union of liquid and solid, where solids dissolve and liquids solidify. You are the pressure who pushes water through seams. You are the rushing water who bubbles from the earth. You are a tiny pool between rocks. You overflow, find your way to join others who, like you, are moving, moving. You are the air at the surface of the water, the joining of substantial and insubstantial, the union of under and over. Wait and not wait. You are the riffle, the rapid, the tiny waterfall that turns water to air and air to water. You are the mist who settles on the soil. You are the plants who drink the mist, and you are the sun who warms and feeds them. You are the fish who feed on insects, who feed on plants, who feed on soils, who feed on fish. You are the fish who become soils, who become plants, who become insects, who become fish, who flow down the river. You are the river who joins other rivers to become a river who is all the rivers and something else. You are the river. You do not stop at the banks where liquid turns to solid. You reach into the sky and into the soil. Water moves through rocks, comes up to form pools far from the fast flow where the rivers move together, seeps down to join still waters deep below the surface, waters who sleep and wake and sleep and mingle with the stones who are the river too. You are the river, who is married to the mountains you have known since they were young, who have given themselves to you as you have given yourself to them. You are the canyons you nestle into, each year deeper than the year before. You are the forests who give you their fallen trees and the meadows you flood and feed, who feed you back their fruits and fine insects, who fly to your surface to be taken in by the fish who with their own bodies again feed the meadows. You are the river who feeds the ocean, who feels the tides pushing and pulling against your mouth, the waves mixing fresh and salt. You are that intermingling. That is who you are. That's who you've always been. You are the river. You've lived with volcanoes and glaciers. You've been dammed by lava and ice. You've carried log jams so large and so old they grow their own forests with you growing beneath. You've lived through droughts and floods. You are the river. You miss the salmon. You miss the sturgeon. You miss the ocean. You miss the meadows. You miss the forests. You miss the beavers and otters and grizzly bears. You miss the human beings. You are the river. You want them back. You want to feel the tickling of the sturgeon, the thrusting of the salmon. You want to carry food and soil to the ocean. You want to cover the meadows as you used to, and you want to give yourself to them, and you want them to give themselves to you as you have done forever and as they have too. Now, pretend you are a forest. You are the bark of trees, and you are the hairy moss who hangs from them. You are the duff who becomes soil, who becomes trees, who becomes seeds, who becomes squirrels, who become owls, who become slugs, who become shrews, who become soil. You are the trees who cannot live without the fungi, who cannot live without the voles, who cannot live without the trees. You are the fire who cannot live without the trees, who cannot live without the woodpeckers, who cannot live without the beetles, who cannot live without the fire. You are the wind who speaks through the trees and the trees who speak through the wind. You are the birds who sing and the birds who do not. You are the salamanders, the ferns, the millipedes, the bumblebees who sleep on flowers waiting for the morning to warm you up so you can eat and fly on home. You too have lived through drought and flood, hot and cold, and you too miss the salmon. You miss the owls, the grizzly bears. You miss the rivers. You miss the human beings. You want them all back. You need them back, or you will die. Thanks. And the last thing I would like to mention is, and it's looking like we're going to get kicked out of here in 20 minutes, so I'll do this, and then we'll do like 10-15 minute Q&A, if that works for people. Anyway, the last thing I want to mention is a tradition of the Cheyenne dog soldiers called the picket pin and stake. Before a battle, a few of the bravest Cheyenne dog soldiers would be chosen to wear sashes of tan skins called dog ropes. Attached to each dog rope was a picket pin, normally used to tether horses. During battle, the pin would be driven into the ground as a mark of resolve. Once the pin was driven, the dog soldier would remain staked to that piece of ground, even to his death. Retreat was no longer an option. The pin could only be removed when everyone was again safe, or when another dog soldier relieved him of his duty. It is time. I have driven my picket pin. I am staked out and willing to give in no more. Where will you drive your own picket stake? Where will you choose to make your stand? Give me a threshold, a specific point at which you will finally stop running, at which you'll finally fight back. Stand with me. Stand and fight. I am one. We would be two. Two more might join, and we would be four. When four more join, we will be eight, and we will be eight people fighting whom others will join, and then more people and more. The questions before each of us now are, what are your gifts, and how can you use them in the service of your land base? What can you do? What does your land base most need from you? How can you achieve it? What do you want to do? And right now, perhaps the most important of all, what are you willing to do? People ask me all the time, you know, Derek, you've given us this information, whatever, this analysis. What do you want us to do? And I always say, what I want you to do is not listen to me, because I don't know how to live sustainably. I'm doing a drive-by. If you want to know how to live sustainably, Is it the Santa Cruz River? What's the name of the river here? San Lorenzo. If you want to know how to live sustainably, ask the San Lorenzo River. It has lived here for a long time. It knows how to live here. Ask the hills. Ask the soil. They will tell you if you ask. And then the important question is, are you willing to do what they say? Thank you. Thank you very much. So many questions? Okay. Do you mind if I try to shorten it? She says she basically agrees with all the brilliant, extraordinary, eloquent... she said she basically agrees with everything I'm saying, but the concern she has, as a longtime political activist herself, is that especially given the extraordinary level of repression aimed toward those who would attempt to use sabotage, for example, against the system, that she's afraid that she might do something and then, you know, just get killed or sent away, and it wouldn't make any difference. That's a huge, huge, huge question. I mean, people ask me quite often why, you know, it's like, why do you write about taking out dams instead of simply doing it? And there's a few reasons for that. And one of them, and I'll come back directly to your thing, but one of them is that my only D in college was in a quantitative chemical analysis lab. So it's like, you really do not want me handling the explosives. I mean, I have friends who get off on, you know, just messing with explosives recipes. And every time there's a new one they find out, they make it in their kitchen just because they love doing that. And I sort of get off on writing in the same way. I mean, that's part of the reason. Another part of the reason is because I don't know anybody else who is explicitly calling for bringing down civilization the way I am and who is mentioning that there are 70,000 dams in this country over 6.5 feet tall. And if we only take out one a day, it will still take 200 years, who is saying all that. And there absolutely needs to be a firewall between the above ground and below ground faces of this. Otherwise, we may as well just go down for recreational mugshots, you know? And but there's the other thing that also sort of stops me on this is, yeah, I would be willing to give my life for the fish in a moment, but I don't particularly want to give my life in it for a symbolic act that doesn't really accomplish anything on the ground. And, I mean, I know so many people, I mean, just at talks, and you know, this is not any sort of breach of security here, just because it's all sort of random, that so many people who have essentially said the same thing. It's like, yeah, I would go down and take out a cell phone tower right now if I knew that there were 200 other people doing it all over the country. And if there were groups who were, you know, just hitting again and again and again, I would be out there in a moment. I don't have an answer to that because I don't know. I mean, one of the advantages that Tecumseh had over us is that he could go and recruit in friendly territory. And we don't have that. There is no, you know, we are all in occupied territory. And I don't. That is something, and I don't think this is too much of a cop-out, that is something that I would leave up to organizers, because I don't have skills in that direction either, but I think that needs to be done, you know, and there needs to be an underground railroad set up. All of that needs to happen, and but I don't have the faintest clue how to do that, but it's a huge, I mean, I'm just dancing around, I don't know how to answer that question. Yes, I mean, I want that critical mass to be there. And that's one of the things I'm doing. I'm essentially, you know, a recruiter for this, you know, this transformation, you know, it's a recruiter for whatever word we want to put on it. I mean, that's what I'm trying to do is to push this, push. I don't know how to bring about that level of organization, especially within, I mean, as you know from my book, Welcome to the Machine, especially within a panopticon. I don't know how to do it. But one thing is really important, which is not said often enough. When I say that I don't have hope, some people say, oh, that means, you know, that you, I don't know what it means, but somehow it means that we should all sit on our asses or something. I don't know what it's supposed to mean because I don't feel that myself. But the important thing, something I don't think anybody says, or I don't say this often enough, but I do say it in the new book, is that one of the things I think we need to realize is that we're going to win. We are absolutely going to win. And I think that understanding, that even makes it a little bit easier. You know, even if I'm part of the vanguard who ends up getting nailed, you know, the knowledge that somebody else is going to come after, even that is a little bit sweeter. And here's another thing that's really helpful, that really helped me to lose some fear around this whole question is, okay, when we die, I guess it's one of three things will happen. Either it's boom, boom, out go the lights, in which case I'm dead, in which case I don't know anyway. Or two, you know, we end up in some other place, in which case I'm going to fight him from there. Or three, we come back here, in which case I'm going to fight him from here again. It's like, what's his name? Kartar Singh Saraba was this Indian anti-imperialist, about 1920 or so. And he's my big, big Indian hero. He was about 18, I think, and he was, caught by the British, and they were going to sentence him either to be hanged or to life imprisonment. And he said, I want you to hang me so I can come back and fight you again. And I love that, you know? It's like, but that doesn't answer your question. How do we make the critical mass? No idea. That's up to somebody else. I mean, because of my ignorance. It's a huge, huge, important thing. You were first and then you? What I think you're saying is that part of the difficulty is that it's not so clear as it was perhaps in the time of Tecumseh as to who us is and who them is. And that creates pragmatic problems. Okay, first, I mean, there's a couple ways we can do. One, I think, is first off, we can prioritize. That I think the ANC was really pretty good at a lot of that by saying first go after sort of military equipment, then military personnel, then corporate personnel. And so there's prioritizing a list. I mean, I think we can all say that Charles Hurwitz is not one of us. I think we can say that. Okay, and I think we can say that. I mean, it's like a great example of this is some guy saying, if you one reason I wouldn't take out a dam is because you kill a lot of people. I said, well, don't even worry about that philosophical question right now, because there are, of the 2 million dams, there are a bunch of them that are tiny, illegal, and the only reason they're standing is because of inertia. And we don't even need to face that more difficult question because we're not even bothering to take out the ones that have no, there are no problems with taking them out. They're only standing because we're too damn lazy to do anything about them. Many of them have no economic purpose. And they were illegal in the first place. The only reason they're standing is because nobody's bothered to take a sledgehammer to them. There's probably a quarter to a half of those 2 million fall in that category. And so there's plenty of work we can do before we even have to face that. Which is not to say we shouldn't, but it's like, that shouldn't stop action, because if we have that question, okay, let's start at the places where we don't have that concern, and we're not even doing that. Okay, I got no problem with the us and them. Dams are them. Factory trawlers are part of them. Dams are part of them. With the salmon, I don't know that would, I mean, in general, yeah, but not with the salmon. That would be a separate issue that's just as important. And so I don't think that's problematical at all. I think what we need to do, if we want to save the Klamath River salmon, is, Iron Gate. And if you've got tons of money, if you're Warren Buffett, who is thinking about buying the dams, great. That's one option. You know, there's plenty of other options too. I don't see that as a difficult question on either a pragmatic or a philosophical level. And it's actually like 1 minute till, so we actually need to stop. But thank you very much.